KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Six.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Seattle Opera's Ring Cycle opens on Saturday night. It's a huge affair, a giant orchestra, a lot of singers, and then there's the backstage magic. Coming up on Weekday, a conversation with Seattle Opera Technical Director Robert Schaub. He's the man who makes all that magic happen. The Human Rights Campaign has released its annual Healthcare Equality Index. The HEI is a survey of how healthcare facilities treat patients from the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community, LGBT community. Both UW Medicine and Seattle Cancer Care Alliance were recognized for being leader in LGBT healthcare equality. What does it mean to provide LGBT patient-centered care? Nikki McCraw is the Assistant Vice President of Human Resources for UW Medicine. She joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
What are specific issues that face the LGBT community when it comes to healthcare?
You know, there are a number of issues that come up, but perhaps I can give you an example that illustrates something that all LGBT people are particularly concerned about in healthcare. A woman is brought into the emergency room in an ambulance. She's unconscious. Her same-sex partner later arrives and is told that she can't see her partner because only family members are allowed to visit. She isn't given any information about her partner's condition. She isn't allowed to make any decisions about her partner's care. Those types of issues wouldn't come up if that couple was a straight married couple. And at UW Medicine, it won't happen if you're a same-sex couple. So we're ensuring that our LGBT patients are treated just the same as any other patient in our healthcare system.
So one thing to have a policy. How do you specifically train your healthcare providers?
That's one of the things that we work hard at. We have training on LGBT issues as part of our new employee orientation for UW Medicine. We have LGBT training for our new physicians as they onboard. We also, in order to be named a leader in healthcare equality, were required to provide training in LGBT patient-centered care to key staff members across the organization. And this included not only members of our HR staff, but members of our nursing staff and our other patient care professionals and leaders within our executive suite. So we ensure that we have training across the system and then try to share that knowledge from within the entire organization.
It's one thing to actually recognize same-sex couples, to think about relationship issues. Are there specific healthcare issues that members of the LGBT community face that perhaps the larger community does not?
Well, I think that there are a number of issues that could come up. In order to receive the best possible health care, you need to be open and honest with your provider about your history, perhaps your sexual history, your lifestyle history. And if a patient doesn't feel comfortable being open with their health care provider about perhaps their sexual orientation or the fact that they're a transgender patient, they may not receive appropriate care. So those sorts of issues come up on a daily basis. And interestingly, HRC statistics showed that 29% of lesbian, gay, and bisexual patients believe they're going to be treated differently by medical professionals, and 73% of transgender patients have that same concern. So it could certainly affect the information that a patient is willing to share with their medical professional.
I would imagine that there are certain medical treatments or healthcare treatments that transgender patients would want that might be different from the wider population.
Of course. That's correct.
Why did you at UW Medicine choose to participate in the survey in the first place? I understand it's voluntary.
It is voluntary. This is the first year that all four of our medical centers, Harborview, UWMC, Valley Medical Center, and Northwest Hospital and Medical Center, as well as SCCA, participated and were selected as a national leader in healthcare equality. We did that, and we're very proud of the distinction because it reflects the values of UW Medicine.
Were there areas going through the survey that you felt you had room to improve?
We always have room to improve, and we've improved every year that we've participated, and in fact, the standard for being named a leader in healthcare equality becomes stricter and more difficult to obtain each year. But we certainly have room to improve. We look at different issues throughout our organizations. We can always improve with additional training. We're a very large organization, so that's a critically important part. One of the things, for example, that we've decided to do this year that we've not done in the past is to create a committee within UW Medicine that looks specifically at LGBT patients and concerns that they might have, and ensure that we're on the cutting edge of those issues and that we're moving forward and incorporating best practices as we continue to grow, so that we can improve.
The Human Rights Campaign does this specific survey. What about other minority communities in our region who use your healthcare facilities? Are they also watching to see that they are treated equally?
I think every group and every person who comes into a healthcare system wants to receive the best possible care and be treated equally. And I think that we do a good job of doing that. I mean, the fact is that it's important because when people need health care, they're at their absolutely most vulnerable time. And being treated with dignity and having access to your family members and being treated with respect is critically important to healing. And we want to provide that, and I think we do a good job of providing that to all of our patients.
Nikki, you mentioned that this is a training that you provide when you hire staff. Does the training go down into the UW Medical School or nursing school courses as well?
It does go into the university School of Medicine programs and trainings that are given to onboarding new physicians. We certainly want to, as we bring new physicians on board, we want to ensure that they're aware of all of our policies and practices and how we do business at UW Medicine and become familiar with our culture, and so it's certainly part of that training as well.
Nikki McCraw is Assistant Vice President of Human Resources for University of Washington Medicine. Thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Coming up in the next hour on Weekday, your worst road trip and the lessons that you learn from them.
Turns out the Ku Klux Klan and a motorcycle convention were in Cleveland at the very same time. They had taken all the hotel rooms.
The lesson is maybe you should call and reserve ahead. What is the lesson that you learned from your worst road trip? We'd like you to call us right now at 206-685-2526, 685-2526, and then join us about 10:15, an hour from now. We'll be talking about your worst road trips and what you learn, for better or for worse. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:15. We're going to go behind the scenes of Seattle Opera's elaborately staged production of The Ring Cycle in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Visitor Center across from Seattle Center, where visitors of all ages can experience work that is improving lives from Seattle to South Africa. Learn more about making a difference at visitorcenter.gatesfoundation.org. Arrive curious, leave inspired.
57 degrees in Seattle, and I just got an updated weather forecast that says it's going to be cloudy all day with a chance of showers and a high of 71. Same thing tomorrow, Friday. Clouds with a chance of showers and a high of 69. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:16. Some thoughts on the importance of ritual in religion and in life 15 minutes from now.
From KUOW's Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. On Saturday night, the curtain goes up on Seattle Opera's epic Ring Cycle. The four operas by Richard Wagner are based on Norse mythology, and they've got enough lust, greed, and violence to satisfy the most devoted soap opera fans. The whole shebang ends with the destruction of the world as these gods and goddesses know it. That's music from the final scene of the final opera, Götterdämmerung. In English, that means Twilight of the Gods. You hear this music, and what the audience sees is an elaborate confluence of singers who rise up from beneath the stage, singers who float over the stage. There's fires burning. There's a live horse. If this was a movie, the filmmakers would have used elaborate computer programs and CG technology to make it all happen. But obviously, opera's performed live. And so the magic that we see on stage was accomplished with people power and some amazing designers and technicians. Robert Schaub is Seattle Opera's technical director. More than a decade ago, Schaub worked with the artistic staff to help realize the vision for the original production.
I'd like to stay in the game right from the beginning so I can be as supportive as possible. I understand the stage machinery in the theater and how this company works, and so I can impart all that on the design team.
What did they say that they wanted at the end of this opera?
Well, it oftentimes starts with just a sketch, a cartoon. Then we start to work on it together. You know, obviously, I know a bit about the elevators and the systems that we have, and so as they start to sketch about what the gods might be doing, I said, hey, you know, we've got this elevator from Parsifal. What if we stuck that in the, you know, we begin, it just unfolds as a big conversation. And then it turns from there into models and paint elevations, and then we do engineering drawings, and finally we get it to the shop floor. So it takes some number of months just to get the concept into a form that we could then present it to the shop.
This version of Götterdämmerung premiered in
2005.
Okay. And I'm curious, because it was the first time that you'd done it. I mean, you were involved from the get-go, but what did you think might be the tricky parts of this particular end scene?
Well, for me, it's you know, whenever you open up a big hole in the middle of your stage and it's dark and there's all kinds of singers walking around and stage crew, and then of course you've got the flying going on. For me, it was really focused on the safety, on doing it enough times and making sure that people were working, really watching out for each other, working slowly to put it together so that nobody got hurt.
How long did it take to get that first crew? I think of it as choreography. How long did it take to get everybody working in sync to make it happen?
Well, you know, once we're in the theater, it's very quick. We do a lot of this with little foam models and, you know, we build things in the office that we can simulate what's going to happen. And so a lot of the choreography and all that business is figured out ahead of time. Because I was figuring this out today. We've only done this, well, at the end of this ring cycle, we will only have practiced this scene 24 times, yeah, total, in all of the times we've done it. So, for example, we're going to do what we're doing tonight, which is this very dry tech, no music, just work through it really slowly. Then we'll do it on Monday afternoon with music, and then Monday night, and then we'll do it Tuesday at the dress rehearsal, and then we'll do it one more time in the orchestra tech pass-through and one more time in the orchestra dress, and then we open. So there's not a lot of opportunity to work on it. So you need to get it right from the beginning.
And how many of these stage crew were with you in 2005?
You know what? That's a great question, because a lot of them. We've got a great. There's been a lot of people that have stayed with us, stayed with me here, stayed with the company for many years. A lot of these people worked on The Ring in 1995, and so I would say half the people that are here did this in 2005, 2009, and now again. So that kind of institutional memory that's there is really important to us.
Oh, yeah, I would imagine that. And also the fact that, you know, it's like riding a bike in a funny way, that the muscles come back, right?
It comes back to you. It's amazing. What happens to me is I sit and go, at first I'll think, oh, I don't remember any of that. And then all of a sudden it'll start to, my brain will start to open up a little bit. And the next thing you know, it floods back in and I remember all of it.
Can you describe artistically, content-wise, what the audience is seeing?
Well, the first thing that happens in this sequence that we call the Schluss is that the Gibbich begins to burn. So we start the immolation fire. Grani, the horse, has come across the stage. And Brunhilde now is, she's got the ring, and she's sort of walking across the stage, and in come the Rhine maidens. We begin the whole water sequence, which is putting out the fire, and these big, giant scenic walls are flying out. And then Brunhilde mimes tossing the ring up to the Rhine maidens, so then they've regained control of the gold. And then she goes off to join the fire. And then all of a sudden we introduce this Valhalla scene, which we're looking at now. And the gods appear and we see that they're being, you know, it's the twilight of the gods. They're being destroyed. And then that's cleared. We have some beautiful music. And then all of a sudden the whole thing is on fire. It appears that we're burning the whole stage down. And then all of a sudden the green forest appears and we have that very final moment, which is probably only about 6 seconds or something, that we look at that pristine picture of the world sort of being reborn.
And that's exactly how I experience it as an audience member. Except I call it all hell breaks loose. And then and then one world gives way to the next.
I think what Spate, you know, he really wanted to do this notion of it being about nature, about the green ring, we refer to it sometimes. You know, if you go into the woods and you see that there's just in nature, there's new growth and then there's older growth and then there's decay. And then there's rebirth coming from that. And so I think that scenically, in terms of how we treat the forest scenes and all of that, we've tried to capture that in this ring.
How has what you guys do backstage technically changed, or hasn't it?
You know, it hasn't for the ring. Technology actually has caught up to us here and passed us. We've deliberately held on to some older equipment because we know how hard it would be to replace it in the middle of trying to do this. For example, the lighting console, some of the computers that control some of the backstage equipment is quite dated now. It comes from the late 90s. And now in 2012, we could do it much differently.
But you don't because you've practiced it with that equipment.
We've practiced it. It's folded into the whole thing to try to change it. Now we probably need more theater time, which you don't really have. For example, if we were to relight some of the show with different equipment, we might need another couple of weeks in here.
It's such an amazing thing to watch and to hear as an audience member, and I was wondering where you are during the performances.
During the performances, I'm out here. I'm sitting in the auditorium watching it. I have tickets for the opening for the first cycle, and I watch it from out here, and I try to not get too nervous. Sometimes the ring makes me a little nervous, but... And then, you know, once we're open, I'm backstage and just kind of hanging around. My work is kind of done once we open. I have to relinquish any kind of control to all these men and women that are really making it happen on the front lines.
So you're nervous. Can you watch it the way I or somebody, well, now I'm a little more informed, but the way an average audience member watches it?
No, I don't think so. Because I'm basically by nature nitpicking it. So I'm seeing every little moment. And by the way, there's lots of little moments in live theater that are happening. I can hear them, I can see them, and then I'm being troubled by that, so I'm having a little bit of a panic. I have trouble going to any theater because, I mean, I like movies for the simple reason that I can't quite figure out how they're doing things. I don't know how they really make Godzilla, but in the theater I'll try to sit and pick everything apart. Oh, how'd they do that? How does this work? Oh, I wouldn't do it that way, you know, that kind of thing. And so it's not easy for me to go to plays or any kind of live performances. You know, people in opera, they always refer to patrons and participants. You know, they don't use the word fan for people that come to opera, except for The Ring, which has a fan base.
Groupies.
Yes. And of course, they come with real clear expectations. Like, oh, no, that's I wouldn't do the dragon like that. Or, you know, no, they didn't do the Rhine Maidens that way. They have these images in their mind, and so they're very hard on us.
When you look at it, besides the nitpicking, are there pieces of it that you think that is exactly how it should have been done?
Oh, you know, I'm really proud of this production. I don't know that we could do better. We did the very best we knew how to do. And I think that for many of us, you know, well into middle age, we all had sort of that kindergarten moment of, aha, look what we did, you know. And we're quite proud of ourselves when we put this together for the first time.
This is the last time this particular production will be seen, at least for a while, right?
No. Well, we're not sure. You know, as you know, we have a new general director coming to Seattle Opera, and Aidan Lang will have to make a choice about whether he wants to present this again or not. We're not going to discard it. We're going to put it back into storage, and we'll see what happens to it.
I, in my experience, haven't seen anything scary or awful, but has there ever been a moment where everybody's caught their breath backstage?
Oh, sure. But I often tell people, you know, when I get asked that question, I tell people that probably the more scary it looks, the more practice it's been and the safer it probably is. You probably have more chance of getting injured walking up a stairway that nobody's really being concerned about, you know. But it's the coordination between different systems that gets more scary. If you isolate any one of them, they're probably really well rehearsed and really quite simple. But when you start to combine them, things are opening and closing and flying, and different people are worried about their particular area. I worry about there being some sort of clash or train wreck, if you will, that could come together. So we really want to make sure that can't happen.
So you'll be sitting in the audience for opening night for the first cycle, and heart beating a little faster?
I think so. I will it. All I can do is have will. And so I will it to be perfect. And, of course, there isn't perfect, but we've worked so hard. The word that comes to mind to describe so many aspects of the ring is stamina. Whether you're playing it in the pit, whether you're one of the stagehands that's worked on it. And so we've invested so much of ourselves in it that on opening night, I just don't want that to not pay off big time.
Robert Schaub is technical director for Seattle Opera. The four-opera ring cycle, about 15 hours of music, opens Saturday night at McCall Hall. The cycle will be performed three times in total, running through August 25th. And right now, this is the last year that this particular ring cycle is scheduled for performance. Longtime Seattle Opera general director Spate Jenkins retires at the end of the season. There are no plans as of yet to revive the four operas. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
. 57 degrees in Seattle and mostly cloudy. Chance of showers this afternoon and a high of 71. It's clouds and showers overnight as well with a low of 58. And tomorrow we're expecting a high just up into the upper 60s tomorrow.
Support for KUOW comes from Delta Dental, with a wide provider network that includes nearly 90% of Washington State dentists. More information and a list of participating dentists are available at deltadentalwa.com.
They call him Brushy One String because the Jamaican musician plays with just one string on his guitar. Sometimes he doesn't even use that one string.
Listen to the voices out in the street. All I know that needs some food to eat.
Coming up on the story, how a musician made the move from rural Jamaica to a stage with Elton John.
Brushy One String, real name Andrew Chin, this afternoon at 2 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. All kinds of great stuff on KUOW2. You'll want to learn more about it at KUOW2.org.
Scott Simon of NPR News here. Together, KUOW and NPR bring you stories that you just won't hear elsewhere. Stories that go beyond the headlines and keep you inspired and informed. Your financial support makes all of this possible. So if it's been a while since you've made a gift to KUOW, please renew your support today. It's easy. Go online to KUOW.org. Thank you.
It's 9:30. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A look at the risks of overdiagnosing cancer in 35 minutes.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. All of us have rituals that we engage in. Maybe you eat lunch at the same restaurant every single day, or maybe you celebrate the holidays every year in a very similar manner. How important is ritual to the human experience? I've invited the Interfaith Amigos in to muse about it. They are Imam Jamal Rahman, co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. Pastor Don McKenzie, a former minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ, and Rabbi Ted Falcon, a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. Thanks, all three of you, for coming in.
Thank you.
So, will one of you explain what is the difference between ritual and habit?
That's good.
Yeah, that's a terrific question.
I think ritual is an attempt to do the exact opposite of habit.
Ritual is the attempt to sacralize or to make special moments in our lives. So rituals are designed to help us awaken to the moment in which we are engaged. All spiritual teachers talk about awakening always being in the moment. It's always awakening to the fullness, sometimes the hidden fullness of the now. And a ritual is designed to get us out of our habitual and bring us to fuller alertness. For instance, a ritual of blessing, the act we're doing, calls us to pay attention and to dedicate that act in a much larger way, attach it to something greater. The danger of ritual is that it becomes habitual. And when it becomes habitual, it loses its true value as a ritual. Hmm. I think of a couple who every time they come together at the end of the day or they say goodbye in the morning, they'll kiss each other. And then over time, that kiss turns to the to that peck, you know, that brushing of lips, you know, where the I love you becomes love ya, you know, and the ritual which helped center us, helped call us to the moment, then becomes habitual, and we lose that precious sense of being wakeful to the wonder of the moment.
I liked what you said, Ted, about the urgent and the most critical need to be present. That's what sacralizes a habit or a practice and makes it a true ritual. I have a story in mind, a true story of Emperor Akbar, 16th, 17th century Muslim emperor, one of the greatest emperors in India. And he was one day praying in the forest, actually. And it so happened that as he was praying and doing the body prostrations, there was a young peasant woman who sort of carelessly crossed his prayer path. Didn't touch him, but she came very close to him. She did not see him. And he was enraged. How dare you cross my prayer path? You might say it's like road rage. And, you know, he was about to pronounce a punishment, and she confessed, and he said, how come you didn't see me? I was praying, and you crossed my path. And she confessed that she was lost in thoughts of her lover, her beloved, and she didn't see him. And before he was able to give her a punishment, she suddenly had the courage to turn to him and said, Your Majesty, but you also were lost in thoughts of your beloved. How is it you saw me? And that really shamed the emperor. He realized he was not present in his prayer. And the story goes, he gave her a very handsome reward. So I like that, to be present. That's what makes ritual a sacred ritual.
Well, how do you maintain that? Then I guess is the question, the big question.
You got to make it a good habit. Community helps, and you know, really, meditative practices of self-awareness. That's the biggest question. How can I remain awake?
I think it's a quality of human being that we go on automatic. You know, and at the beginning of learning anything, it's like learning to shift a manual shift automobile. Or learning to type, you know, it takes a great deal of attention, and then we're able to do without thinking about it at all, and it just kind of happens. And the same thing's true about all behavior. And the possibility is to catch ourselves when it goes on automatic, to go, oh, wait a minute. This, we used to be paying attention now. We used to, you know, there was something important in the moment, and we've started taking things for granted, and we've lost our way.
Don?
You know, I'm inspired by what my colleagues have said, and I've been thinking about weddings as rituals in my tradition. And because I think that for many, the wedding service, possibly because the language can seem archaic to some, although that's been updated, but also because there isn't a spiritual need. Maybe they're getting married because their parent in a church because their parents want them to, or they think it's the right thing, or whatever. And so, don't have the opportunity to think carefully about what is being said and why, which, of course, is what I would try to do for them ahead of a wedding. But one of the things I've always said is that a wedding as a ritual makes public something that's already happened. They've already committed themselves to each other. Well, why make it public? And the wedding service says very clearly to gain the support of, quote, God and these witnesses, because we all need support. And so I think that's one aspect of how a ritual functions, whether it's a wedding or something else. But a relationship that is brought to life, light by a wedding, has a terrific vulnerability to becoming unconscious or, you know, just habitual, as my colleagues have said so well. And so in some ways over the years, I've tried to encourage people to look at the words that were used for their wedding and say to each other, how do we see these things? How did we see them? How do we see them now? And, you know, how can they be helpful? I mean, we can go to sleep in our relationships all too easily. We can go to sleep in anything all too easily. And being present, being in the moment, being mindful, being awake, because of the way things are going in our culture these days, we're either obsessed about the past or anxious about the future, and there is no present. They come in together so tightly that we're just not there. We're preoccupied, and that's very unhealthful. It really leads to all kinds of destructive things.
Speaking with the Interfaith Amigos, Pastor Don McKenzie, Imam Jamal Rahman, and Rabbi Ted Falcon, well, that all very much points to the fact that ritual is incredibly important for the human experience. Do you think it is?
It does. And I was thinking about the rituals that we do together, because there are certain rituals that we've been observing that kind of have grown out of our time. We've been together, we've been working together for over 11 and a half years. One of the things we do is whenever we sit down together to eat, we each do a prayer from Jewish tradition, a prayer from Christian tradition, a prayer from Muslim tradition. The other thing is whenever we get together in our meetings, and which are often, we'll start with a prayer. Each of us will do a prayer, and then we'll start with check-in. This is ritual. And then we'll focus on the business of the day, you know, and what we're doing. And those rituals help ground us. And those times when we've forgotten or neglected them or pass over them too quickly, we're the worse for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jamal?
I have another story in mind, if I could tell you. A story of the mullah about the power of ritual. And here's the mullah, and this is allegorical. He's in jail for life, but he's very happy because he has heard the news that his sheikh or teacher has permission to visit him. And why is he happy? Because he's sure the teacher will slip in a key or a weapon to escape. The teacher comes, and he gives him just a lousy prayer rug. You know, the prayer rugs Muslims pray on. And the teacher kisses him on the cheek and goes away. And the mullah is very, very disappointed. A prayer rug? How will this help me escape the prison? But he has time on his hand. So he starts the ritual, the Islamic ritual. He spreads out the prayer rug. He puts his hands to his head. Allahu Akbar, Allah, you're so great. He doesn't mean a word. He bows, he prostrates. He does the Islamic ritual of the body prayer. And as he begins to do this over the days and weeks and months, he suddenly begins to realize that there's a special design in the prayer rug. He looks closely. It's a design of an escape route from the prison. And that has many meanings. One meaning is the power of the ritual of prayer. Another one is the power of being present to that ritual that you're doing.
Mm. Well, how do you stay present? Maybe each of you personally, when it's so easy to fall asleep, besides the rituals that you have in yourself, or together, when you're by yourself and you find yourself thinking about tonight I have to do this, or and yesterday that meeting didn't go very well, what do you personally do to try to snap out of it?
It's hard. I mean, we all are vulnerable to this. I think for me, two things. One is to simply sit quietly and not just think, but to not necessarily meditate in the deepest sense of that, but listen and try to put chaos and disorder at arm's length, even though the need for control is always quite great. But that does help me. The other thing that I think helps me, and this is something I think that has evolved, especially during our time together, because I was thinking about the rituals that my colleagues were describing and why haven't they gotten habitual. I think it's because of the thankfulness that we continue to feel and the drama of what we're doing, penetrating the barriers that have historically separated us, keeping us from any kind of cooperation that could effectively address big, difficult issues. That kind of gratitude, I think, doesn't always, but I think helps me to see the freshness and the hope in what we're doing.
Ted?
The question is, what do we do when we've gone to sleep? You know, when we've...
When you catch yourself having gone to sleep, yes.
You know, generally speaking, I suffer.
How
and,
so?
And I know that. I kind of mean that as both a joke and seriousness, but the consequence of going unconscious and just living life automatically and kind of not being present in the moment is going to wind up with some kind of suffering. It gets painful. It's like going down roads that I've gone down a million times before and needed to find my way out of. Needed to find my way back. Ritual, wakefulness, being present is not just, they're not just words. They call us out of the compelling pull of polarization in our culture, in our world, and in our ego state, you know, where we're always comparing, we're always contrasting, we're always judging, and that gets painful. And it's like, can I realize I've gone asleep sooner, you know, before it has to get more painful? And that's in a relationship situation, in a work situation, in a general life situation. But it's usually the anguish that accompanies going on automatic and stopping living consciously, that ultimately will be the reminder.
Jamal?
For me, two things. One is I always remember when I go astray in not being present, the words of that famous Buddhist teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, who said, the miracle is not to walk on water. The miracle is to walk on land. And that brings me back to a certain extent. And knowing my personality, the practice I do after I remind myself of that wonderful phrase or that saying by Thich Nhat Hanh, I talk to myself. There's a wonderful saying in Sufism that says a Sufi is a son or daughter of the present moment. So whenever I am going astray, I say, Brother Jamal, and the key is to do this with compassion for oneself. Brother Jamal, I call myself Brother Jamal. Brother Jamal, a Sufi is a son of the present moment. Come on, Jamal. Come on, Brother Jamal. And that brings me back. So self-talk for me works really well with compassion for self.
Do you think you can live life without ritual of any kind?
That's an interesting question, too. You ask good questions. I don't think so. You know, whether people call it a ritual or not, we get into certain behaviors that are prized. A couple might have a favorite song. They might have a favorite nickname that they call each other. Somebody might have a favorite way of driving their car. All particular things that may not be associated at all with any religious tradition that are rituals we do in our lives that help us stay on course. Which leg do you put in your pants first? You know, I know that's kind of a trivial thing, but
It's a ritual.
I'm aware that getting dressed is a ritual. You know, there is a certain pattern that I follow. You know, when do I open the closet? What do I, you know? It's just, this is, and I know that there is certain comfort in that, that it allows there to be familiarity and some kind of groundedness and grounding. It's possible to live without calling it ritual, but I don't think it's possible to live without ritual.
Actually, I'm absolutely certain that everything becomes a ritual. We create a ritual consciously or unconsciously, mostly unconsciously. But I'd like to suggest that because we always do create rituals, we can make every mundane activity a prayer. And that becomes a very beautiful practice. For example, Prophet Muhammad, before he walked through a door, he would say, "Oh God, open to me the doors of thy mercy." It is suggested by Sufis that if you are going to sleep, taking off your clothes, make it a prayer. "Oh God, may I be peeling off layers of my ego." And if in the morning you're putting on the clothes, oh God, may these clothes be a mantle of divine protection. So if we're doing rituals, why not make it a sacred prayer? Because you said ritual is sacralizing it. So to sacralize a mundane activity is beautiful.
Did you want to add anything?
I think there is a natural urge toward meaning and so forth. And I think that's part of what my colleagues are saying, that we search constantly for ways of finding meaning. And the ritual provides it. The habit doesn't. And I like, you know, that distinction. And, you know, how we get dressed. You know, if it's a habit, then it's not functioning the way it's supposed to. Am I right, Rabbi Ted? Yeah.
Right.
But if it's a ritual, then there's something that's being given that helps and points toward healing in some kind of way.
Pastor Don McKenzie is a former minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ. Imam Jamal Rahman is co-founder, Muslim Sufi minister at Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. And Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. Together, they're the Interfaith Amigos. Thanks once again for coming in.
Thank you, Katie.
This is Weekday.
And this is a great ritual.
That's a great one.
Katie Sewell brings that ritual to us on Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
And you can hear more from the three Interfaith Amigos at KUOW.org. Conversations about death and the afterlife, the meaning of light and celebration, and much, much more. Just go to KUOW.org. and use the search word, amigos. It's 58 degrees and cloudy in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 71 with a chance of showers.
After Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, the president asked Congress to declare war.
Since that time, though we have fought in many, many wars, no president has ever gone to Congress to ask for a declaration of war.
The Congress is absent.
I'm David Green. We'll talk to Marvin Kalb about his new book, The Road to War. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow on KUOW's Morning News Magazine, which airs from 4 to 9 a.m.
Spend less time maneuvering around an unwanted vehicle and more time enjoying one of Seattle's best seasons. Donate your vehicle to KUOW by calling 1-866-KUOW-CAR. It's easy. 1-866-586-9227.
The number of jobs requiring FBI background checks skyrocketed after 9/11. And now a new report says those records aren't always accurate and could cost innocent people their jobs. We'll shed some light on the problem of flawed background checks this afternoon at 1 on KUOW2. It's 9:51. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A look and listen back to some female detectives from the golden age of radio at 10:40.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. The baby birds have hatched, and now they're all over your neighborhood learning how to fly or calling out to their parents for food. If you found one of those baby birds alone on the ground after it fell out of its nest, would you take it into your home so it could survive? That's what Clark and Evelie Beck did when they found a baby pigeon. They took her into their West Seattle home and they raised her. Much of the time, the bird calmly roosts in a cardboard box on their kitchen counter, but right now she's all alert and puffed up. Why? Well, there is a mechanical toy bird in her box. Katie Sewell brings us this story.
Don't you like that red bird? So I don't know if that puffing up is a fear or a trying to look big and frighten the critter off, whatever it is. What's wrong? You hate that bird, don't you? Yeah, you do.
So how often does she live in this box?
She lives, that's her main home. Yeah, she has a cage outside and she's not very well toilet trained, so we have to kind of watch her.
Now she, here's her food. She likes millet, which is a small grain. And Cheerios. But Cheerios are best. She really likes them best of all, don't you? You want to get out?
Yes. Grab.
Come on. Don't you want to get out? Nobody's going to bother your egg. No. Come on. You can get out. Now you'll mess up. I'll show you how I put her outside.
She enjoys being out.
Well, a little bit. A little bit. So she just goes in her box here. Now go ahead and do your business. Get it all... so you won't mess up your box.
What do you call her?
Well, I call her Birdie. And Evelie named her Pidgeon, but she doesn't recognize Pidgeon, do you? No, Birdie's a better name for you. And we got her when she was just little, fell out of a nest. We kept her, and Evelie fed her. And just, you feed them, you know, grain with milk, and you just spoon it down them. And, but she raised her, and then... the darn bird pecks her all the time. Now, see, she's a little scary now. Come on up here. Come on up, and we'll bring you back in. You can do an indoor flight for us.
So why do you not call her a pigeon?
Because of rock dove, see. Pigeon is such a common word.
They are actually rock dove. That's the proper name.
Yeah. Being a flying critter, they always... keep their weight low, and that's why she, you know, she'll go quite often every time they get a chance.
Yeah, she empties out, so to speak. Yeah, yeah. Let her go.
Here, I'll let her go, and she'll fly back to her box. Here, I can hear them whistle.
I pick her up and take her outside and bring her in. She isn't, but she won't. If I sit, she won't fly on my shoulder. But she, in a moment, she'll fly on his.
Well, as the rescuing mother, how does that make you feel?
Doesn't really matter to me. I'm not sensitive about it.
You have her in a box. Is this the oven rack?
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And I thought we'd try to impress you before we can. We get a taller box.
This whole thing would be temporary. That we'd give her away. But then we kept her so darn long.
3 years
We're
ago.
Afraid to let her out in the wild anymore. I don't think she'd go away anyway. I think she'd stay around.
Now that you have a pigeon, rock dove, living in your home, do you see the pigeons that are on the street differently? The ones you see walking through traffic?
I notice them more. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
She'll come off her eggs here pretty quick, and then she'll come up and she'll nuzzle there, see? Now, if you notice, that's the way the female and male bird do. So I think she thinks I'm a male pigeon or something. I don't know.
Well, it's interesting to me because, and I give her the same type of attention, but she'll pick me.
Yeah.
Bite at me. In fact, it's kind of interesting.
Let's see if we can hear it. Oh, we can. Ow.
But she does not do this to you.
No, if I put my hand in there now, she's liable to bite me.
Yeah.
Because somebody's been in there.
Riled up.
Put your hand in there.
Come here. Come here.
Oh,
yeah. She wouldn't be bite. Come on. Come on. Come over here. Give me a kiss.
It's Clark and Evelie Beck who took an abandoned baby pigeon, a baby rock dove into their West Seattle home to make sure she survived. And she did. And once the bird was fully grown, one day it just flew away. They told their story to KUOW's Katie Sewell. This is Weekday. And now, the sound of the day. I love these prehistoric sounds we've been getting, Bernard.
Sounds like a dungeon door.
It's close. It's close. Our weekday listener Theron sent in that sound, and he writes to us, "I'm moving into my new apartment. Before that, I was couch surfing, and I kept most of my things in storage. During the move, while I was digging things out of that storage unit, I was struck by the sound of the hydraulic freight elevator at the storage facility." Sounds like a horn solo and percussion on a Tom Waits album. Let's listen some more. I think you're right. It sounds more like a dungeon to me. Wow. Maybe it was a haunted storage facility. Wow. That's pretty good. What interesting sounds are you listening to? Listen how it goes up like that. Record 30 seconds of what you hear and send the sound to us along with the story behind it. You can email your audio file to weekday@kuow.org and be sure you include sound of the day in the subject line, and maybe you'll record your baby rock dove that was abandoned on your street, like Clark and Evely Beck's. We'd also like, right now, your stories about road trips gone awry and what you learned from them at 10:15 in just about 16 minutes or so. We're going to take your calls, but you can get a jump start by calling our listener feedback line at 206-685-2526, or you can email your worst road trip story and what you learned from that horrible experience, weekday@kuow.org is our email address, and stay tuned.
On the road again, just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends, and I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again, going places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road again. Road again, like a band of gypsies, we go down the highway.
The one and only Willie Nelson with On the Road Again on KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. It's 9:59. NSA leaker Edward Snowden has left the Moscow airport and officially entered Russia after being granted asylum. That and more of today's news in a minute.
Is someone who prepares a lethal injection for a death row inmate the same as an executioner?
Where are the ingredients coming from? Who is compounding the drug?
Georgia law is protecting pharmacists being challenged, and an execution is delayed while the whole question of secrecy is examined. A capital case next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Nature Consortium, presenting the Arts in Nature Festival at Camp Long, August 10th and 11th, featuring dance, interactive arts, and acoustic performances by Cloud Cult, Leela Vision, and many others. Schedule and more information at fest.naturec.org.
Every Saturday night, the Swing Years and Beyond takes you on a tour of popular music from the 1920s through the 1950s. I'm Amanda Wilde. Join me for the Swing Years and Beyond.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.